You might be noticing a similar theme to last week, how this story turns on its head the power dynamic of outsider and insider, and how the Creator lifts up the lowly, just as Hannah and Mary sang about. This is the first time we meet Elijah in the biblical text, and he just bursts on the scene with no introduction, booming into the king's court, proclaiming a calamity is coming. We don't have any indication in the text of who he is. There's nothing about his family. There's no pedigree, like he was the son of someone. And geographically, Elijah coming from Tishbe is over at the edge, kind of, like on the east side of the Jordan, over on the other side of the river, away from the centers of power. So Elijah is a kind of outsider. He's not a court prophet like Nathan was, who was close to David, King David. And yet he seems to be in some kind of dynamic relationship with God. One other thing you might have noticed is that we have no record in the text of Elijah receiving a word from God. It's not clear that God instructed him to utter this prophecy. In speaking so boldly to the king, does Elijah inaugurate his own prophetic career? As one Jewish scholar wonders out loud, is he going rogue here? Tellingly, he says, it will not rain until I give the word, not until God says the famine is over. Now let me back up a little bit here. You might remember that King Ahab has married Jezebel, who was a princess from Phoenicia. And in Phoenicia, they worship Baal, or Baal. And Baal is a storm god, a rider on the clouds, someone who brings rain and the rainy season, even, and fertility to the land. And Elijah's very name, which is Eliyahu in Hebrew, means the Lord is my God, or Adonai is my God. So in saying there will be no rain, Elijah is very provocatively declaring that the power of Yah, or of Adonai, who created all things, is greater than the power of Baal. Now this is at a time when in the northern kingdom of Israel, it wasn't just Jezebel, but people all across the land were worshiping Baal and the Baals as much as well as Adonai. So there's a bit of tension already there. If Elijah did actually speak this dire word, which resulted in famine for an entire region, without having received God's instruction to do so, it seems that God is going with it. Adonai is committed to ensuring Elijah's safety and well-being, but not only Elijah's. It seems like God is saying, well, now you've put yourself in danger, so we're going to get you away from the king's court and go to this stream, and I'll make sure that the local ravens will give you something to eat. If it's true that Elijah didn't fully think through the implications of his proclamation, if he hadn't considered the massive suffering it would cause thousands of people, now he is experiencing some of the hardship that comes in the wake of his words. At the same time, God is removing him from the center and giving him protection from Ahab and Jezebel's anger. And then eventually, as the sun beats down and rains don't come, the stream dries up. And so at God's word, Elijah is on the move again, this time crossing the border into, as irony would have it, the region of Sidon, which is in Phoenicia, where Jezebel is from, and where the most vulnerable of Jezebel's kinfolk are suffering the most. Now, of course, in the larger context of the Hebrew Bible, we have vulnerable people named in particular categories. I think you probably could name them for me. God commands the people to look out for especially, who is it? Widows, orphans, strangers or foreigners, right? Now, clearly this woman, to Elijah anyway, is a foreigner, as well as being a widow, so there's two out of three. Oh, but she also has a child, so in the minds of the ancient world, we kind of have all three categories here covered. And now, Elijah has to depend on her hospitality. He needs her to survive. Elijah, who was recently speaking boldly to a king, becomes this woman's guest. From her response, it doesn't appear that God has actually given the woman in Zarephath a heads up that she would be feeding a hungry prophet for a while. Does she resent Elijah just showing up and asking for food in such desperate times? And even especially the way he asks, it's like, can I have a little water? Oh, by the way, could I also have some bread? Oh, while you're at it, could you please make me a little cake of bread and then feed your child? Does she oblige him out of fear and self-preservation, meeting the need of someone maybe she considers to be a powerful person? Does she have some kind of gut-level trust in him or in his God? She does say, as Adonai lives, she does say, your God, actually, so it's not her God, but she has maybe some recognition of this God. Or has she already given up so completely and just is expecting to die so soon that she figures, what the heck, it doesn't matter. I'll just do this. But the text gives us no commentary about the woman or her motivations, and there's no elaboration about the fact that she's an outsider. She simply opens her home and her extremely meager resources to this stranger in a time of painful scarcity. And ultimately, she and her child receive provision from the Creator, from the source of life. By the way, kind of an interesting twist here, in welcoming and providing for a stranger, she's following Torah, the instructions of God to the Israelites, even though she's a complete foreigner to that law. Clearly in this story, God's abundance knows no borders. God cares for people who are in precarious places. Being in relationship with Adonai leads Elijah to learn more about depending on others for what he needs. Elijah must learn to receive from God via the stream and the birds, and from a person who was even more of an outsider than he was, who was much further from centers of power, and through whom divine power and provision flowed very clearly through this widowed foreign woman in a life or death situation. But questions remain. If we turn to Jesus' sermon in Nazareth, we hear a sense of them. Why does this particular widow get to live when others do not receive a miraculous gift from God? Why should thousands of Israelites have had to suffer and languish in a famine to prove that the maker of heaven and earth is more powerful than Baal? We can relate to the anger and the pain of the people in Nazareth who become so enraged that they try to hurl Jesus off the cliff after he says this. What's the use of one of our own being an acclaimed healer if he's just going to waste it on those other people and not rescue us from our heavy loads? You can kind of understand the question. What about all the people that God doesn't rescue? The ones who do starve in the famine. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, but I do not have answers. Or at least I can't promise that what I do have will be satisfying. But what I am trusting is that God does see and does care about each one. And I hear Jesus challenging people to move from a scarcity mindset to a daring trust in divine abundance, and calling for mutual sharing across borders and barriers instead of circling the wagons and protecting our own. Jesus does speak in a very provocative way. But his pointing to provision and healing that is received by these foreigners, Naaman and the woman from Zarephath, doesn't actually negate the wide love of God for the people of Israel. It doesn't supersede God's love for us even in our privilege and wealth. But it's a reminder that divine love and goodness and healing and care flow to everyone, to the people we deeply dislike, to outsiders, to everyone we consider to be completely undeserving, to everyone, and especially to the most vulnerable, to those who are closest to the edge. And perhaps part of the message is when we spend our energy reaching across the walls that falsely divide us and separate us from people who are different from us, we might all experience the enoughness that God gives. We might all have that experience of divine abundance. Certainly, we see from experience that God does not protect anyone from terrible things. But the one who is love is present with us, sustaining us, and with us, even in the experience of death itself. And there is enough divine presence, there is enough love for everyone. Last week, we looked into like our inner lives, places within us that might be marginalized or pushed to the edge. But there are social and tangible ways that many of us experience being at the edge and in the center. As a congregation, especially as an affirming and welcoming congregation, you are a bit at the edge of Mosaic Mennonite Conference. I don't know, you can tell me if you think I'm wrong about that. But you're choosing to embrace and celebrate those of us who, because of our queerness, are outsiders in some Christian settings. You're offering hospitality and some real safety to people who carry this vulnerability as part of our identity. And in the process, occasionally you become targets and maybe are viewed as outliers. And in celebrating and affirming queer folks, you are embracing our strength and goodness and resilience and gifts, some of which we have because of painful experiences. And you embrace us as we bring sometimes a perspective that is different from what's considered mainstream. So together we have the opportunity to share an experience of vulnerability, at least some of the time. And there are also many important ways that a lot of us are placed in the center, and I include myself, simply because we are white in this culture, or we're labeled with that. And because we have a certain amount of education, or we've inherited a certain amount of material wealth, or we know how to navigate some of the systems of our society and some of the institutions. In this way, I think you're a lot aware of this. A lot of us hold power and need to be intentional about how we share that power and how are we using that power in collaboration with people who are denied or mistreated because they have little money or because they've been labeled as people of color in our deeply stratified society. Without a commitment to keep learning and practicing this mutual care and intentional power sharing and wealth sharing across these painful and artificial but also very real borders and walls, if we aren't aware and intentional, we end up participating in the systems that keep the walls up and continue to violently oppress people. Elijah and the widow of Zarephath give us a chance to reflect on the ways sometimes we are outsiders and sometimes we're insiders, and the way God loves to invert those identities and keep us on our toes. Like Elijah, We don't always see ahead of time the effects of our words and actions or how we will need to depend on others. But we can stay in relationship with the living one who does see and who will keep calling us into places of receiving and learning and mutuality, mutual sharing. There is enough love. There is enough safety and hospitality if we continue to share them. As we continue to follow in Jesus' risky trusting. So let's keep listening for divine nudges to stand at the edges and trust Creator's abundant care and loving presence, even in the hardest times. And in each other's faces, may we see this loving divine presence, helping us to know we have what we need.